Today on The Grave Talks, a conversation about the haunts of Richmond with Chris and Beth Houlihan. Richmond, Virginia may be one of the most haunted cities in America, and for good reason. Built on centuries of conflict, tragedy, and transformation, its streets carry the echoes of war, the pain of enslavement, and the residual energy of those who never left. In this episode of The Grave Talks, we sit down with Beth and Chris Houlihan of Haunts of Richmond, whose mission it is to keep the city's haunted history alive through their immersive tours and deep-rooted research. From the blood-soaked fields of the Civil War to the Virginia State Capitol, the Houlihans share how Richmond became a paranormal powerhouse and why the dead aren't done telling their stories. Today on The Grave Talks, a conversation about the haunts of Richmond with Chris and Beth Houlihan. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to chat with me today about Richmond and the haunts of Richmond. And it sounds to me like Richmond has a lot of haunts.
Oh, yes, we do.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having us on today, Carol. A lot going on here. Got hundreds of years of history. So it's given us a lot of material to work with over the years.
That's what's interesting, because I always like to dive into whatever I'm talking about. So I Googled history of Richmond. Oh, my God. There's so much that's happened in that city, but you even take it back to before it was Richmond. You know, it goes way back to Indian territory and things. So much has happened on that land over the years, including wars.
Yes.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Of course, the Civil War is probably the thing that Richmond is most well known for, because, of course, we served as the capital of the Confederacy during that time. But there's so much more to Richmond's history outside that four-year stint. And that's actually one of the things that we really like to try and highlight, that the city is not just defined by those 4 years, that we have so much more history on top of that. And it was also very directly touched by during the American Revolution as well.
Yeah.
And often a pivotal point in the American Revolution, where if certain things had not happened here, what we know today wouldn't have happened.
Isn't it interesting?
Mm-hmm.
And because I was reading, like, the city of Richmond itself goes back to 1700s. I think it was like 1780s or something like that.
1737 was when the city was founded.
Okay.
It became the capital during the Revolution.
Yep. In 1780, that's when they moved the capital of Virginia from Williamsburg to Richmond.
So when you think about that history alone, mm-hmm. that's pretty extensive. But then it goes way back. I was reading like a timeline of Richmond, and it goes back to when they were just exploring.
Yes, I mean, so all the way back to the early 1600s. Mm-hmm. You had Christopher Newport and John Smith. They come sailing up the James River. Of course, at that point in time, they were, you know, searching for that passage to try and get across the continent. They weren't going to find that, and particularly not on the James River. They got to the point where we call the Falls of the James, which is the area that now Richmond is grown up around. But they reached that point. They met some of the native tribes. They basically kind of put their foot down on the land. And then at that point in time, they turned around and basically went back down to the coast for a while. And things were kind of quiet for some years. It was a while before...
Tensions between the native tribes and the Europeans grew.
Those tensions, of course, did grow over the years, but it was in the later half of the 1600s when you started seeing some of the European settlers try to come up and actually try to put roots down here in the area that would ultimately become Richmond.
Now, the two of you own Haunts of Richmond. You do ghost tours. How did the two of you end up owning Haunts of Richmond?
So the company was actually founded by another couple, Scott and Sandy Bergman, and they started it as a haunted house in 2004. All of the different rooms in the haunted house were based off the local ghost stories and legends.
Oh, that's
And
interesting.
during the first year, a lot of people started coming in asking, when does the walking tour leave? So after that first year, that's when they decided they would open up the walking tour. And basically, Sandy would run the walking tour side of things, Scott would run the haunted house. I come to work for the company about 2 years later, after my best friend says, "Hey, I'm giving ghost tours. Why don't you come and, join me on one of them?" And we did, and we enjoyed ourselves immensely. And after that, she's like, "Hey, we're hiring." I said, "Hey, I'm there." And I started the following year.
And then I wind up coming on board a couple of years later. Actually,
Courtesy of one of the ghosts.
there it is a bit of a ghost story as to how I ultimately came on board. But kind of long story short was that so Beth and I, we've been married since 2006, and we were together for years before that. So we do predate our time with Haunts of Richmond. And when Beth was giving a lot of tours, and I was not yet doing anything for the company, I would just kind of hang out and bide my time and
Go to the bar.
go to the bar.
Why
But the
not?
at that point in time, we had an official partnership with the Poe Museum here in town. The tourists would have the opportunity to go into the museum. There was a stipulation that there had to be a Poe Museum staff member on hand to open up the museum for the tours, which perfectly makes sense. Well, there was that responsibility pretty much wound up falling regularly to one of the museum employees. Up until the point where one night, one of the resident ghosts at the museum decided to have a little too much fun with that particular museum staff member, scared them off. They quit on the spot, and that left everybody in a lurch because who was going to open up the museum for the ghost tours? Well, since I was in the neighborhood anyways, everybody kind of looked at me and said, "Hey, instead of going to the bar, do you want to hang out at the museum while the tours are going on?" And so I was actually hired by the museum to be the Poe Museum staff member that opened the museum for the tours. And I did that for a couple of years. Eventually, the relationship between Haunts of Richmond and the Poe Museum came to an amicable end. There was, business considerations. It made sense for everybody to go their own way. We're still on very good terms with them and still do events with them from time to time. But when that happened, I basically came on board with Haunts of Richmond at that point and carried on.
The museum, it's in an older house that he did not live in,
Correct.
correct?
Yes.
He was not born in Richmond, but he lived there as a child. Is that
So
right?
he spent about a third of his life in Richmond.
Okay, so quite a while.
He came here when he was three, and his mother, of course, died from tuberculosis. She gave her last performance here in town, and he was then fostered by the Allen family. Up until he went to college, unfortunately, failed horribly at college because he ran out of money, had to come back, and then left Richmond to sort of start moving up and down the East Coast, did a stint in the military, that sort of thing. But after his marriage to Virginia ended, and she was buried, that's when he came back to Richmond, and he always said, "I'm back home. I'm a Richmonder." So he considered himself a Richmonder.
Is that coincidental that he was adopted by the Allen family, or did he adopt their name?
He was actually fostered by the Allen family,
Fostered,
and
excuse me.
he took the Allen as the middle name to show that connection to them.
There was some hesitation on his part to do so for many years, because there was a little bit of animosity between him and his foster father, John Allen. So he would regularly sign a lot of documents, Edgar A.
Hey, Poe.
Poe. It wasn't until he eventually did adopt the full like Edgar Allan Poe, but it was not something that he fully embraced for all of his life.
So a lot of his belongings, they're in the museum, correct?
Oh yes. They have one of the most extensive, if not the most extensive collection of Poe artifacts to be found anywhere in the world. So they have a very good collection, a lot of which they do have on display, but then they do have archives that have loads more of his writings and other artifacts that they just don't always have room to put on display. So yeah, they got a lot going on down there.
You know, and he wasn't connected to that actual building.
He would have been familiar with it.
Yeah.
Because it was Oldstone House then. Is actually on the original deed to the city, basically. We know it was erected by 1737. We don't know how much earlier it had been put up. But he would have walked by it on a regular basis. He also visited that property, what is now known as the Memorial Building, that actually had Carriage House. Because that had a tea house in it at one point in time. And when Lafayette had his 50th year anniversary tour, Poe was part of Lafayette's honor guard. And Lafayette had tea at that tea room with Peter Francisco, a good friend of his from the war.
Yeah.
So he would have been familiar with the property.
Yeah. And the Old Stone House that is the cornerstone of the Poe Museum, it is the oldest building standing in Richmond today. And also, you can find maps from the early 1800s, from the time that Poe was alive, that even at that point in time, they were already calling it the Old Stone House. That's how long it had been around, even by the early 1800s.
Do you believe that the Poe Museum is haunted?
Absolutely.
Yes.
But not by Poe.
Yes, definitely. Poe is not amongst them. We do need to emphasize that because a lot of people love to say, oh, well, it's the Poe Museum. It must be haunted by Poe. But that's, in this case, just simply not true. Most of the hauntings that are there are actually attributed to the family that called the Old Stone House and the property their home for generations. It was the Ege family. They lived there generation after generation for over 150 years. Yeah. Many of the spirits are attributed to the Ege family. We can say there are probably some of the hauntings that are there may be attributed to artifacts related to the museum. But again, those might be other individuals, not necessarily Poe himself.
Since you spent some time there, Chris, not in the bar, did you have any experiences?
I honestly can say I personally did not. Beth and I are like two sides of a coin on this. I am somebody that does not really have paranormal experiences as far as I don't see apparitions with my own eyes. I haven't heard disembodied whispers and whatnot with my own ears. I have participated in many paranormal investigations where things might be caught on video or camera, or you catch something like a electronic voice phenomena, something like that. Well, I'm there in the room and you catch it after the fact when you go back to review the evidence. But I personally don't really have those experiences, whereas, well, Beth is different.
I'm the hot spot.
Yeah.
they like to find me. They like to sometimes bruise me. I can see them. I can hear them. I try not to openly communicate, but that doesn't always work.
Well, because you don't always have control over that, I would think. You know, because sometimes you can be prepared for it mentally, and I think that helps, knowing I might walk in someplace and experience something, and you could kind of prepare. I would think other times things might just kind of wash over you. And
they do.
There's so
actually
wild.
One of the buildings at the museum I choose not to go into because the first few times I went in there, every single time I got bruised.
Ooh.
Yeah. And this is actually one of the entities we believe is attached to an object at the museum and is not a member of the Ege family. There's actually a staircase from Poe's childhood home in the Memorial Building. And a lot of negative things tend to happen around that staircase, not just to me, but to other people. Other people have been slapped on that staircase. Some people have been shoved down it. I've just been bruised when I've been near it.
Yeah. But, yeah, we think that...
just.
Yeah, just. We have a theory that it might be something to do with John Allen, because those would have been his stairs. And as I mentioned before, there was some animosity between Edgar and John throughout their lives, or particularly as Poe, as Edgar got older. And we think that there might be the fact that something of John Allen's that it wound up in a museum that was effectively dedicated to Edgar might be grating on him a little bit. So,
He was also known not to be very nice towards women, and it's women that are most often targeted on those stairs.
that's a working theory as to what might be attached to the stairs there at the Poe
I mean, it
Museum,
does make
particularly in the Memorial
sense.
Building.
It makes sense, doesn't it?
It does.
You know, but it's interesting to me because in life, Edgar Allan Poe really struggled. It wasn't like he was this famous author that was highly successful and lived in some mansion. He had a
That's
lot
it.
of struggles.
Unfortunately, all too true. He was one of the first to try and make a living as a writer, which was really unheard of back in the day. And that was what the main cause of the schism between him and John Allen. John Allen wanted Edgar to become a man of business like himself. And when Edgar did not pursue that, John Allen basically, kind of put him out on his ear. The idea of Edgar trying to pursue a living as an author was kind of embarrassing to John
Right.
Allen. So,
He was right up there with his parents being an actor.
And so, yeah, he certainly struggled throughout his life, as far as making ends meet. Did the best he could. By the time he passed away, only at the age of 40, when he passed away, he was effectively he was well known as a writer, as somebody in the literary community, but that did not make him a wealthy individual.
And it's so interesting, all of these years later, he's legendary. I think that would be interesting for his foster dad to be like, people are still coming here. Every day they show up to look at his things. Now, Beth, for you and your abilities, has that been something you've had your whole life?
I remember it as early as six. I grew up in parsonages, and my imaginary friends were actually paranormal friends. I've been aware of that. It's something I've found that other people in my family line have the abilities as well. So it might be something that's just passed through the blood. But again, it's something I don't actively try to promote or. I don't try to turn anything into a séance when I'm out giving a tour. I like to respect their privacy as I hope they like to respect mine.
So growing up in parsonages makes me think, A, your parents just liked them, or B, your parents were like maybe your father was a pastor or something.
My dad was a pastor, and he
Okay.
also had abilities as well,
How
which made
did
him a very unique pastor.
I was going to say, how was he able to kind of square those things up?
A lot of it is my dad took a more shamanistic approach to his pastoral beliefs and realized that there's not just one way out there. And I think that really helped him reach a lot of the people that we were always sent to sort of problem areas. And so it helped him reach people in different ways. And growing up with that open mind, I think really helped my sister and I when we started to come into our abilities.
Yeah, you've never had any choice about this
No,
because
unfortunately not.
it's going to find you. And Chris, on the other hand, you've had more choices. I'm going to guess maybe at a time you're curious, maybe even skeptical of it.
I have always been curious about it. Well, I have never really had those abilities, nor did I grow up, you really even grow up around people with abilities like that. I've always had a curiosity for it. I was very fortunate that my parents took us, my brother and I, around to a lot of historic sites growing up. So we did get a good exposure and appreciation for history in general. As far as the interest in the paranormal, I think it just kind of came around organically. I just liked the stories surrounding it. And it actually, it's a little funny. It might sound a little campy as well, but one of my favorite movies growing up was actually Ghostbusters. So, I mean, I watched Ghostbusters so many times over. Of course, it is a, you know, it's a comedy type movie and whatnot, but the spooky stories surrounding that got me interested in looking at and reading more paranormal type, you know, material in general, not just fictional stuff, but some of the real life hauntings as well. So kind of came into it a little organically. The interest has always been there, even without the abilities that Beth and others around us do share. So getting involved in this was not really much of a stretch for me at all. It wasn't something I expected to get into, but I enjoy it very much and I'm happy to be here.
Now, you were saying the original owners of Haunts of Richmond, Scott and Sandy, they had the house that they toured and then the museum. You guys have expanded on that.
Because we did. When we took over in 2016, we only had 3 walking tours at the time in different neighborhoods. We had a 4th that we had started to develop, but it wasn't fleshed out enough. So we kind of put it on the back burner. And then once Chris and I came on, that was my first project. I wanted to flesh out that tour and get it back on the books. So it took me about 6 months to find what I needed to make it a 90-minute tour. And we started that up the year after we took over, and we also went year round that year.
Yep.
Instead of just being seasonal.
Yeah, because it was always beforehand, it was always just a May through November type thing. So actually, like, you know, 9 years ago, we would have just been getting ready to
start our season,
quote unquote, open our doors for the season, start the tours for the season. But now we take it all year round, and we have also added 2 additional tours and neighborhoods to our portfolio as well. So we have a total of 6 different tours that we have around town here. They're all broken down by neighborhood. Each one you will get a good variety of different parts of Richmond history. It's not like we don't have a tour that's just focused on like Civil War hauntings. Mm-hmm. That's not how we do it. We want to make sure that each of the tours manages to embrace multiple facets of Richmond's history. And coincidentally, by breaking it down by neighborhood, we managed to do that pretty well.
Yeah. We also offer pub crawls and haunted dinners in the winter. We also have a partnership with the John Marshall House, where that's a 50-50 split tour between us and them. The first half, you're in the John Marshall House with their docents and also with a paranormal investigation group called CPRI, Center for Paranormal Research and Investigation. And they are the group that is allowed to investigate the Preservation Virginia properties. They also investigate a lot of the state park properties here in Virginia. So one of their representatives, one of their team members is also there, and they will talk about what they find on the investigations. Then the second half of the tour, we take you outside into the neighborhood and talk about some of the other hauntings that surround that property and that neighborhood.
Yep.
Now, I want to talk about the John Marshall House in particular. But first, I want to ask you, when you put these tours together, how much research did you do? Because it's not like you can just go, okay, that I'm sure that one's haunted.
There's usually 6 months to a year of research that we do ahead of time. The newspapers, honestly, from the 1800s are our biggest friends because they used to publish the ghost stories from the neighborhoods.
Interesting.
And it's just become a wealth of information that we dive right into newspapers.com and start finding what was going on in these neighborhoods, especially if the neighborhood has been bulldozed in part way, you know, in the name of
Progress.
Mm-hmm. My favorite word with this city.
I will stop you just for a brief second there. Yes, we have unfortunately lost a lot to in the name of progress, but we have also preserved a fair bit as well. And
just not Edgar Allan Poe's place.
Yeah, and nothing associated with Poe. None of the places he lived or worked, unfortunately.
Oh.
But there is a lot of other places that have been saved.
Like John Marshall's house.
I do have to, you know, give some credit where it's due. The preservation effort here in Richmond really kind of ramped up around the 1960s. Mm-hmm. By that point in time, unfortunately, some things had been lost to time, but they've done a pretty good job since then.
Yeah.
So.
I find that interesting because that's kind of the case with most cities, that in the 50s and 60s, I guess they just didn't think anyone would ever be interested in these old houses or anything. And so they just tore them down and they put up these buildings that were just boxes, you know?
Yeah.
It's just the architecture from the 60s and 70s in some places is good, but overall, I wouldn't say it's my favorite period of architecture by any means.
No, not at all.
But they were just okay with tearing down these buildings. And it happened here in my town, but it happens all over.
Mm-hmm. It does. And I mean, I do have I've had the privilege of being able to travel to a lot of places. And I do see, I appreciate the old buildings that I find there. But then you can see the scars, if you will, of, the slashes of new development through mm-hmm. historic districts where mm-hmm. you just know in the back of your mind that something was lost there mm-hmm. over the years, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's like that house was not here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, the John Marshall House, though, I did find this very interesting because he's basically attributed kind of creating the Supreme Court as we know it today.
Yes, he was, of course, the Supreme Court's justice, but then also the Chief Justice for the longest term. But it was the Aaron Burr trial that actually solidified the Supreme Court as its own entity separate from the other two bodies of government. At that point in time, Jefferson was president and was putting a lot of pressure on Marshall to convict Burr of treason. Burr had already been tried twice and let free. This time, Jefferson wanted to see him hang. But Marshall followed the letter of the law, and he said, no, per our laws, he's not guilty. And standing up to the president at that point in time really made it clear that president doesn't have authority full authority like he thought it did.
It established the judiciary as that third and equal branch of government to
check the other two.
So, I mean, that's one very pivotal case that he did oversee during his time on the Supreme Court. And that trial took place right here in Richmond. But he heard many, many cases over the years that did time and again help to solidify the Supreme Court's stature as that equal branch of government.
Mm-hmm. They weren't always great cases as we see them today.
No, well, unfortunately, the unfortunate side of that is that he also oversaw a lot of cases regarding the institution of slavery, mm-hmm. and he basically help to uphold the institution of slavery time and again over the years, which was also particularly conflicting in the fact that mm-hmm. he was a prominent slave owner in his own right. So should he even really have been hearing those cases?
We would have considered it conflict of interest today, but that wasn't a thing back then.
So very, just as all of so many of the founding fathers, that there's the good and there's the bad.
Right.
And I will say, I want to emphasize that the John Marshall House, as we know it today, does a very good job of highlighting both sides of that of that case, such as it is. They, of course, talk about John Marshall and his work on the Supreme Court, but they also do a very good job of highlighting, in particular, the lives of the people that John Marshall had enslaved at that house during his time living there. So they do a great job of making sure that everybody's story associated with the John Marshall House, that those stories are told.
And he lived there for a very long time.
Yes, over 40 years.
He built that house for him and Polly after they married, and they moved right in. She passed away in the house. He actually passed away up in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
He was going up for surgery on gallbladder stones, and it didn't
Didn't work.
Didn't work this time. The first time it did, but not the second.
But yeah, they moved in there in 1790, and I think, was it 1834, 1835, he passed away? It was something like that. It was in the 30s that John Marshall passed away. But that entire time, from 1790 on, he lived there at the house here in Richmond.
Beth, what do you think about the house? Do you think it is haunted?
Definitely.
What makes you say that?
Actually, just about every time we have a tour there, we have something happen. The most recent tour that we had, we were downstairs checking people in. Brad was talking about the next investigation that's coming up, and all of a sudden we all stopped because somebody was walking around above our head in the main parlor. And we could literally look at the security camera and there was nobody in the room. Another time, same room. We were actually in the middle of the tour and I was over by the bookshelf that holds quite a few of his law books. And I heard what I thought sounded like a rodent ripping or moving paper, like when they're digging in their cage.
That would freak me out.
Well, first of all, I'm thinking I'm in a historical home next to ancient books. Where's the rat?
Yeah.
Please don't be in the books. And then I realized it wasn't that noise that I heard. What I heard was somebody actually flipping pages in a book. And so after that experience, they actually started putting, CPRI started putting recording devices near the bookshelf to see if they can capture that sound.
Were they ever able to capture it?
Not that we've heard yet. But we're actually going to be at the next investigation that they're having there. So I'm hoping maybe I can trigger it.
Yeah, they've caught all kinds of different evidence there. They've caught the very distinct sound of like an older gentleman who's been walking for a little while and gets kind of tired, and the sound of sitting down and that mm-hmm. kind of relief sound.
And along with the creak of the bench he's sitting on.
Yep. So they've caught that when nobody's there in the room. The key thing about their investigations is the way they do it is they just set up the equipment and then they leave to make sure that the human element is actually taken out of the equation. They take a very scientific approach.
So they're usually outside in their mobile van monitoring live and recording every time they hear something over the recordings so they can go back and verify that that's what they really did hear or that it got actually recorded. They've had times where they've actually been outside as somebody inside adjusting one of the pieces of equipment, and the person inside hears a train whistle go off, which is plausible. We do have a train line running not too far from the house, but people outside didn't hear the train whistle. It was only heard inside the building.
And that wraps up part one of our conversation about the haunts of Richmond with Chris and Beth Houlihan. For more information, visit their website, hauntsofrichmond.com. If you'd like access to all of our episodes, including the archive and advance episodes, everything commercial free, become a Gravekeeper. Sign up on Apple Podcasts where you can try it for 3 days free, or go to patreon.com/thegravetalks. I'm Carol Hughes, and for all of us here at The Grave Talks, thank you for listening.